This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 42, The Answer to Life, the Universe, and Everything. Well, a bit of everything anyway. And I have the pleasure to be joined today by myself. In the now traditional, can anything done twice be a tradition? First podcast of the year, I step away from diving into a topic with an esteemed guest and take a more top-of-the-mountain view of the landscape. And in a bumper fun pack, we will cover a whole range of topics, all of which pertain to fintech. We start today's show with the relevance of Star Wars, move on to the relevance of beer, and deep dive into a topic that applies to fintech and to the whole of our perception of the world, the media, mainstream and indie. Next, a review of key themes from 2015 at UK FinTech, and finally wrap up with some thoughts about the future. In the next episode, I for one will be incredibly glad to go back to the far easier task of asking folks smarter than I the answer to life, the universe and everything, or at least what's going on in their corner of the fintech phenomenon. So, in the meantime, plenty to talk about, and let's get on with the show. Over Christmas, I got to see the crash-bang-wallop fan-fiction J.J. Abrams-directed film that is Star Wars 7. Rather like a Chinese meal, it seemed filling at the time, but after a while you're hungry again, wondering what was so filling about it. Anyway, if Star Wars 8 includes a fifth Death Star that needs to be blown up, I ain't going. However, it was entertaining, apart from the sitting through the dull bits where you just think for a few minutes, this tedious space chase is here just so they can make some video game spin-offs. It was also very poignant to see the main trio aged by half a lifetime, a unique cinematic moment that is only possible to fully experience if you saw the original half a lifetime ago when, like Luke, Han and Leia, you were rather younger yourself. Mind you, Chewie seems to be holding up well. I guess all that hair disguises the wrinkles. Sadly, as corporates are all about ROI rather than art, Disney didn't take the film in the direction of the books written about what happened after Star Wars 6, and which I read that Lucas had preferred. Namely, the challenges rebels face when they are the establishment. In many ways, it's much easier and more fun storming the Citadel than managing it. This was a journey George Lucas had lived. In his own words, he ended up becoming the very thing, a studio mogul, that he'd started his career vehemently opposing. It's also a journey very relevant to fintech. Almost every fintech rebel will fail to storm the Citadel. Some are already cozying up to the Citadel's establishment, and a tiny few have already sold out, in both senses of the word. I wonder how many will stick with the rebel values throughout the journey. Will one of the big names still be an indie or, quote, alternative, unquote, in 5 years' time? I think we can get some insight into this with beer. Two indie brewers made big splashes, in the UK fintech world in a professional way, as well as being a fave indie techie tipple in 2015. BrewDog excelled itself in the crowdfunding arena by disintermediating the disintermediators, in raising its own crowdfunding itself. Curiously, I don't recall any of the equity crowdfunding platforms celebrating that enhanced disintermediation. Camden Brewery raised funds and became a poster child of those who think equity crowdfunding is an accident waiting to happen by then doing a cheaper deal with a private individual. However, in a busy year, they ended selling out to Anheuser-Busch and taking the money, and crowdfunders allegedly came out on top. Back to this point about can rebels or indies survive or will they all sell out? The beer market is well ahead of the fintech world in that phenomenon of indie brewers selling out to the mainstream, and so the story of what happens next, always the same thing by the way, is better known. BrewDog wrote an interesting post, nailing our colours to the expletive-deleted mast. As always, all links are in the show notes at londonfintechpodcast.com. In listening to this quote, we can wonder what year we need to substitute for this to apply to fintech. And I quote, 2015 has been a bad year for craft beer. Global beer megacorporations, the ones who destroyed, bastardised and commoditised beer over the last 50 years have been acquiring craft breweries left, right and centre. Let's be honest, the intentions of these big companies are completely clear. They cut costs, they cut people, they cut corners and they take pride in doing so. Their god is market share and their stock market valuations. They act accordingly. Craft brewer's god is amazing beer. At BrewDog we don't cut costs, we overinvest in the two things we care most about, our beer and our people. And after some revealing case studies, a further line to recall, which would apply to every small co I've ever known, selling out. Outgoing founders always say nothing will change, except everything does. And the reality is, they are powerless to stop any changes. So, at one level, this is just capitalism, or I would argue corporatism. Corporates, with their privileged everyday access to the machinery of government, have so tilted the playing field in their favour, everything eventually rolls their way. As an example, you try paying no tax on your income or your profits. Only the likes of Amazon, Google, Facebook, Cadbury's, Rupert Murdoch et al. Manage that trick. At another level, though, it strikes right at the heart of fintech. Let's take the most prominent example, alternative finance. What is it like when it's no longer alternative and simply mainstream? Will there have been any point whatsoever other than in a few folks making a lot of dough? Where will the indie/rebel cultural values be then? Moving on from Star Wars and beer to the media. It's impossible not to ingest media, whether it be TV, newspapers, YouTube, blogs, or social media. It's a world where someone is always selling you something, even if only their viewpoint. The media is the only window through which we view most of the world, physically, socially, or culturally. Our daily wanderings cover an infinitesimal percentage of the globe's surface, or palace of possibilities of human discourse. Apart from a very limited primary experience yourself, and secondary experience via your mates who are in the sector, the media, in all its guises, is the only way that you or I form our views on the fintech phenomenon. Of course, all mainstream media outlets have always viewed and distorted the world through their particular lens. What would the point in being a press baron be otherwise? As we get almost all of our information on fintech via the media, and as this is a strategic meta view of what's going on, let's have a deep dive into the sector. I'll cover this in three sections. First, the media's war on truth. Secondly, it's the economics. And thirdly, hype. So first, the war on truth. The war on truth is most painfully apparent when we look at the huge neo-imperialistic surge of the Western powers, chiefly the US, of course, and their de facto poodle, the UK, who have created chaos in many Middle Eastern countries, firstly by secret funding of guerrilla groups and then later military intervention. It's a by now standard playbook, the end result being death and chaos. See, for example, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and now Syria as glaring examples. And the war pigs will just love to do Iran. It's too many decades for them since they were allowed to pull the strings there. War has always been big business, and really is big business now. Witness the $100 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia. What big business wants it gets. Corporates may not get to vote once every 5 years, but they do get lobbying and drafting access every other day in between. In most countries, we have a one-party, two-brand system and no real choice. Just look at the hysteria uniformly cast over the new opposition leader in the UK when he suggested that rather than spending £100 billion on new nuclear weapons, whose only use would be to kill hundreds of millions, we spend it on something rather more helpful to humanity. To put this £100 billion into context, it's enough to run every accident and emergency hospital department in the UK for 40 years. This return of the imperialistic war pigs is largely dependent on a Goebbels-like media churning out official propaganda. Let's take one painful example. Last year, four whistleblowers who were drone, well, operators is the euphemism, but state assassins is more accurate, cracked and couldn't take it anymore. They wrote an open letter to President Obama informing him of what it was actually like. To quote from indie media The Intercept, which was launched in 2014 by Gwynne Greenwald and Laura Poitras of Citizen 4 and Edward Snowden fame, I quote, US drone operators are inflicting heavy civilian casualties and have developed an institutional culture callous to the death of children and other innocents. The killings are aiding terrorist recruitment and thus undermining the program's goal of eliminating such fighters, the veterans added. Drone operators refer to children as, quote, fun-sized terrorists and liken killing them to cutting the grass before it grows too long. At the press conference, Bryant said, the killing of civilians by drone is exacerbating the problem of terrorism. We kill four and create 10 militants, Bryant said. If you kill someone's father, uncle or brother, who had nothing to do with anything, their families are going to want revenge. All these goings-on, and the briefing about what is being done in the names of the US citizens, went totally unreported by the US mainstream media. Oh, and for an FS angle, I quote, over in the USA, the four whistleblowers who revealed the official callousness and lack of concern over civilian deaths arising from US drone strikes have had their bank and credit cards accounts frozen, apparently by executive action under anti-terrorism legislation, despite having no criminal charges brought against them. Furthermore, last year HSBC closed the bank accounts of various leading Muslims, without explanation. Peter Oborn in The Spectator magazine and on the BBC investigated this. And from a technical FS angle, the interesting thing was the role of a single database called WorldCheck, which is owned by Thomson Reuters and used by 49 of the world's leading 50 banks for KYC checks. We discussed in LFP 032 with WorldRemit the double whammy if you happen to be a migrant worker from a country beset by war and terror. Remittances are even more costly for you. Back to the war on truth in a broader sense. It's not just the war that suffers from Orwellian distortion. I'll turn to Indymedia soon, but one excellent example was watching on YouTube via my TV over Christmas a couple of hour long talks by Yanis Varoufakis. He's the ex-finance minister of Greece who was kicked out in the summer of 2015 around the Greek crisis. Of course, I knew from the mainstream media I'd read about it that he was an extremist. Only he isn't. I was particularly impressed to hear him talk eloquently with far greater honesty, depth and rigour than any politician or news outlet on the whole crisis and his concern for both the creditors and debtors. As he, an economics professor in passing, said, the euro was badly designed at the outset and remained so. Whether Greece was in the union or not, cracks would always appear when the weakest member would then take the strain. And then, given their policy, it would always have been the poorest people in the weakest country who paid the price. Fainting schoolchildren, teachers et al. Like war, this is real stuff. The package offered to Greece was opposed not just by him, but by those ultra-hardcore folks at the IMF and ECB, who all said the pain should be shared between creditors and debtors. So how come a diverse media produces such conformity of output all too often? Terrible lies on the most important topics, war, economics, and it's a whole other podcast in itself, health. According to a great infographic I saw tweeted recently, in the US there is a vast, apparent diversity in media outlets. 1,500 newspapers, 1,100 magazines, 9,000 radio stations, 1,500 TV stations, 2,400 publishers. Wow. But all of these are owned by only six corporations, GE, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. So not many balls to squeeze then by the secret state to ensure the right output, eh? Naturally, a quotes war on terror, unquotes, is actually a war by terror, and it needs a war on truth, and that's out there big time. Of course, the sickening spread of death that we pay for via our taxes is the worst example, but it goes all the way. Mental health is another example of state and corporate collaboration. The drugs, once you get all the studies filed away and not submitted, don't work, or rather, they don't work any better than placebo. At this point, however, the war on truth doesn't seem to be impacting fintech too much, though I've heard of warnings given to some fintechs that are near government, not to criticise government processes, so it's always near the surface. Turning on to the second aspect of the media's distortions, the economics of the media. The media has been one of the economic subsectors most changed already by a digital world, for which read interweb/smartphone. I was surprised over Christmas talking to a long-time journalist for a major national at how low rates are for articles. Well, I was also not surprised given the vacuous journalism in many cases, or just powder-puffed reformatting of press releases and so-called surveys/studies. The most obvious phenomenon in 30-plus years of commuting into London by train has been the change of reading habits. In the beginning, most folks would have a newspaper, now far fewer do, and most folks sit neck craned down staring at their smartphone. By contrast, I can safely assume that those commuters are pretty much using the same banking services in relatively similar ways that they did 30 years ago, even if they don't need to visit bank branches as much and do online banking as the channel. The actual products and services are provided by the same institutions with pretty much the same mentality. Early in last year, I went to a talk on the future of the media at one of the Big Four, an evening with interesting consequences, another story for another time. In terms of media, though, it was a disappointment. More accurately, it should have been labelled how media corporations see the future of media. I asked the first question about the independent media, and after referencing the podcast and its role with respect to FS reporting, mentioned the example of Russell Brand's YouTube channel, which, with over 1 million subscribers, has more fans than any of the UK political parties and more circulation, as it were, than all but two newspapers in the UK. Of course, anything outside one's reality tunnel doesn't exist, and a rather poor answer from the editor of a national newspaper petered out into the fact that they do quote tweets in some of their articles. Oh dear. Most mainstream newspapers barely touch on fintech very much at all, and then, given the economics of their sector, they rarely manage to scratch the surface. So then we turn to the independent sector. No doubt PhDs are written on media studies courses about what the indie media is, but in the widest sense, it's all of us who put content into the interweb, and in the narrowest sense, you might say it's anyone who publishes regular content on a topic. And generally, the economics are we all provide content for free. Of course, given the poor quality and distorted content from most mainstream media conduits, most of us, particularly in fast-moving or key areas, use social media to find out what's what. At best, one can find real experts. Say, for example, I follow a wonderful guy called Ray McGovern on US foreign policy. Ray, who's over 70, was a lifetime CIA analyst who rose so high that he ended up giving the president's daily intelligence briefing. He's founded a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, who set out to contradict the downright lies that the US government put out. In the UK, I followed Charles Shoebridge, an ex-MI5, MI6 man, who, in my tweet feed, keeps me alert to the latest lies by the UK government war pigs. And of course, this carries on. Actually, most of what I watch on TV these days is from the independent media via YouTube. Moving on from the war on truth and the economics of the media sector, we turn to hype, which affects both the mainstream and the indie. You too have no doubt spotted that you can't trust the mainstream media, and that good independent media is far more honest and far more human. No android-like newscaster dolls spouting the propaganda. A journalistic concept I came across last year that is interesting at this point is the concept that has been championed by Julian Assange, that of primary journalism, which in essence means referencing the direct material, in WikiLeaks' case, what members of the government are actually saying to each other, for example, always very different from what they tell you or I. Let's take the Euro crisis. Almost every article you or I read is at best secondary, or more likely tertiary, or in many cases pure views and opinions. It's in essence a story about a story about a story. And each person telling it distorts it in their own way. In a way, the London FinTech podcast aims to be primary journalism. I talk to the folks at the coalface about what is really going on. The problem with indie journalism, however, especially as it reflects FinTech, is that it is beset with ludicrous hype. VC dollars by a lot of PR companies who spend their time ensuring that underpaid mainstream journalists with often no background in FS print whatever they want them to say. On Twitter and LinkedIn, many folk commenting on FinTech have no actual involvement whatsoever. Many folks involved in it in the 2014-2015 bubble had no background in either tech or FS. Some of them learnt fast, the rest talked absolute bollocks. So hype, lies and spin beset the indie sector. As I mentioned before, it's hard work finding out what's really going on. It's far easier to write hype-filled articles about monetizing data, virtual reality in FinTech, or Bitcoin. I've seen figures suggesting there are millions employed in FinTech in London, to which the letters W, T and F spring to mind in that order. FinTech investment figures keep being bidded up and will soon overtake the cost of Trident. On the last round of these, I was talking to an old FS IT person who said that the latest number he'd seen was greater than all the IT spend in the UK of all the banks put together. Madness. Or, as Alexandre Gaillard put it in LFP 039, with typically Gallic philosophical insight, it's FinTech porn. Right, after that macro digression into Star Wars beer and the media, let's have a quick look at UK FinTech in 2015, before moving on to wrap up with 2016. A year ago, I made 5 forecasts. Let's mark my own homework. The first was less spin. Wrong on that one. In some cases, there have been improvements. I'd single out here Alt-Fi data with respect to P2P, which is real primary journalism, as it were, real hardcore facts and data. Otherwise, the spin cycle goes ever faster. The second prediction was a shakeout. This has definitely happened. The hypesters in chief at level 39 have moved on, and fluffy bunnies in general are quieter. Many startups have fallen by the wayside. In most well-known subsectors, consolidation is well advanced. Thirdly, a maturation and breakup of FinTech into subsectors. This has happened. With respects to maturation, John Reagan in LFP 037 honestly explained about Platform Black's historical large losses, which is a prime example of the sector maturing and dealing with the truth rather than spin. With respect to subsectorization, I don't know any serious players who devote any serious time to FinTech conferences per se. I know a lot who will go to a payments conference or a P2P or a tech or insurance seminar, etc. Fourthly, I predicted a groupthink mentality in subsectors. This has definitely happened. Bitcoiners live in a parallel universe where it's all wonderful. Although, as we'll come on to, this is rapidly being rebranded as blockchain, but equally ludicrously overhyped. P2Ps and equity crowdfunders live in their own worlds, etc., etc. Fifthly, I said that new financial services will get more solid, and indeed it has. Challenger banks like Aldermore and Shawbrook are now listed. The likes of Funding Circle raise ever more capital and are in several territories. The serious players are getting serious, and the performance scale of fintechs is getting logarithmic, i.e. the best ain't twice as good as the average anymore, it's more like 100 times better. So 4 out of 5 on my score. Marking one's own homework always produces high numbers, what? What about some other key points from 2015? Investment management fintech per se went nowhere. Nutmeg is pretty much out there alone, and the lack of competition tells you all you need to know. More at the tech end, I can barely bring myself to utter the childish words, robo-advisors. At best, it's ludicrous hype for conduits to, in essence, zero-fee ETFs. At worst, it's some idiot who thinks an algorithm can beat the market. Insurance fintech was another dog that didn't bark. We keep hearing it's about to take off, but this is generally from those who are part of the hype cycle trying to create some business for themselves. In practice, there are a handful, and someone spoke to me recently about the excellent Bought by Many. In LFP 027, their CEO Stephen Mendel and I discussed the dynamics of why insurance fintech is such a hard market to crack. Bitcoin gets less and less press coverage, and its price only blips when some country, mainly China, finds its citizens illegally exporting currency that way. As to the blockchain Uber hype, at a practical level, I've yet to hear the strategic case for having a distributed database with all its manifest disadvantages, which must precede the tactical case that blockchain is a good way of doing that. As always, the hype is from those who are selling something, and echoed by those who are tertiary at best. To give you a feel for the emotive reaction in London, I recently received an invite to a breakfast meeting, including the following words. I don't want it to be just another gabfest for techno geeks, and I definitely don't want it to be an opportunity, yet another opportunity, for a monomaniacal exposition of how blockchain is going to change the world. As I've iterated time and time again, tech has its place in FS and fintech, a very, very important place, but FS is not tech. It's a highly technical and highly regulated activity, quite unlike any other type of tech, ad tech, mad tech, etc. Going back to developments in 2015, P2Ps continue, as I've written about extensively, not to quantify the risks for investors. Equity crowdfunding as a whole continues to use the inequitable equity that is B shares, as well as having next to zero transparency around amounts raised, successes, failures, and performances of companies compared to their, as you can imagine, very hyped financial forecasts at fundraising. Accelerators and incubators would have collapsing share prices if they had share prices. I've never got more than one answer when asking London fintech folk to name successes from these programs. As Alexandra mentioned in LFP 039, small fintechs have wised up to being educated about entrepreneurialism by people who aren't entrepreneurs. Tech fintechs almost all found out that the chance of selling anything into a bank is next to zero and the timescale is, well, let's put it this way, several fundraising rounds long. P2P was the first sector to sound like an old-fashioned, old-establishment FS sector, with some ill-advised comments in an FT article about it being very hard to explain what fees they charge and it might only confuse people. Yeah, right, heard that one a few times before. To be fair, some P2Ps do fully disclose. Off the top of my head, a hat tip to Anil Stocker, Market Invoice Supremo. LFP 030 is a real mustn't-miss episode. And to John Goodall at Landerbay, LFP 035, who has also brought great transparency to stress testing. Mike Laven, CEO of Currency Cloud, one of the fintechs I respect most, spoke in LFP 026 about how the vibe between fintech and banks is cooperation these days. In no senses can banks go away, as long as what money is just credit from banks. All of those fintechs of all descriptions I know who raised money in 2015 said it's a long and painful process, belying completely media spin about walls of funds being available. Corporate governance continues to be a dog that doesn't bark. It's a very grown-up issue which has barely hit the radar horizon of fintech, but it exists for a good reason. Would you rather give your money to a fintech with a board comprised of founders and funding VCs, all of whom have the same non-independent interest? Or would you rather give it to one that has some real non-execs, chairing audit committees and risk committees, just like in grown-up companies? Without trying to be comprehensive, I'd sum up 2015 with a seemingly trivial, yet accurate statement, that a tiny few fintechs did very well and are adding value to the economy. And that in itself is more noteworthy than it sounds. It's been a long time since anyone in the City of London could name a handful of new entrants who are making a real difference, if not in profits yet, certainly in times of mindshare, culture and business models. A hearty congratulations to all those. So wrapping up with 2016, where is all this going? To put things in perspective, financial services remains dominated something like 99.999% by incumbents. At most in 2016, we're likely to see the last 0.009% drop off. But from a different perspective, at best the indie fintech culture has a lot to offer. There is perhaps no more exciting place to be right now than in a top player that's going somewhere. I know folks and incumbents who are coining it in, but by and large they don't actually enjoy their jobs being highly paid soldiers in the clone army. Furthermore, fintechs focus on clients, and offering them simple, clear propositions and transparent value is compelling. Some folks believe innovation is exponential, but they really are the hypesters. In my experience of FS, it's a punctuated equilibrium. Mostly nothing changes, and then every now and then something exciting comes along. The challenge for all of FS, both old and new, is the crazy state of micro-regulation. It makes Stalinist central control look liberal. At least the Stalinists just set output targets for factories and didn't attempt to micromanage everything within them. In LFP 033, John Siegel, fintech partner at Fox Williams, spoke about the way in which fintech regulation is becoming the new square peg and inhibiting innovation. Triangular pegs need not apply. Rather than make forecasts, after all my views are rather implicit in my review of 2015 and not much changed on New Year's Eve, I'd like to return to my main themes today. Firstly, that of the Star Wars saga. How many rebels will succeed? Secondly, that of beer. What will happen when a few sell out to the establishment? Will some rebels remain indie forever? Thirdly, the problem we all have of seeing through a media war on truth, mainstream media which pays so little those precious in-depth analysis, and an indie sector which ranges from folks who spent a lifetime understanding something to those rushing to join gold rushes with no prior experience. Well, we'll all see what 2016 has in store. I'd like to wrap up by thanking all the listeners for listening, thank those who have sent me feedback for it, all of which has been very kind and most appreciated. I'm most gratified when folks say that they've learned from these as well as been entertained along the way. I'm also gratified when folks spread the word on my behalf that my main job is paid consultancy on the fintech regulation to government, big banks and fintechs, as well as to the people via paid journalism. Without some funds coming in, I couldn't keep up this expensive hobby of going to all the trouble to put out what I hope is some of the most hardcore, hype-free, grounded and accurate long-form content on fintech, and more than the odd laugh along the way. Finally, I'd like to pay homage to Lemmy of Motorhead, who passed away over Christmas. He certainly never sold out, and in an interview some time ago, said that he hoped to be remembered when he was gone for honesty. He also had integrity. It didn't matter whether you liked him or his music or not, but he was himself. He never tried to be a second best anybody else. In his autobiography, his adage, an artistic adage that goes completely against the capitalist fit yourself to the market riff, was to play your own music. Your audience will find you. That's an adage I followed on the London FinTech podcast, and I'm glad my audience has found me. Thank you for 60,000 downloads in, so far, 121 countries worldwide. And if any of you go to Greenland, please do download the podcast, even just once, as it's an awfully big gap on my map of global domination. May you play your music in life, and may your audience who likes your music, both personally and professionally, find you. Live long and prosper. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.